Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how might Donald Trump's growing apocalyptic, dehumanizing, and violent language affect American politics in the near and the far future? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Donald Trump's political rhetoric in this election year has risen to a fever pitch. While campaigns have often argued that their campaign is necessary to save the nation, the use of language that's both apocalyptic and dehumanizing is on the rise, with the former president claiming there will be a bloodbath if he does not win. The dehumanizing language about asylum seekers and migrants at the border, and numerous other examples we'll be discussing today, the discourse in the United States is becoming more dangerous. On today's show, we will examine the use of this language and ask whether Trump's campaign constitutes something new in American politics, and what does the dehumanizing language mean for the political and social future of the United States, with a particular eye to political and private violence in the country. Our panel today is David Livingstone Smith. He's professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, The Most Dangerous Animal, Human Nature and the Origins of War, and Making Monsters, The Uncanny Power of Dehumanization. Roger Peterson is Arthur and Ruth Sloan Professor of Political Science at MIT. He's the author of Understanding Ethnic Violence, Fear, Hatred, Resentment in the 20th Century. In 20th century Eastern Europe, excuse me, Death, Domination, and State Building, the U.S. in Iraq, and the Future of American Military Intervention, and Emotions and Backlash in U.S. Society and Politics. And David Altaidi, Regents Professor Emeritus on the Faculty of Justice and Social Inquiry in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University. He's the author of Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, The Media Syndrome and Gonzo Governance, The Media Logic of Donald Trump. Thank you all very much for joining us, sharing your research and your insights into Donald Trump. And David Altaidi, I'm going to start the conversation with you. You've explicitly written this book on the media logic of Donald Trump. Is Donald Trump unique in American politics, or have we been sort of building to this moment with this kind of dehumanizing and apocalyptic language?
Well, I think both things are true. I think he is unique. He is the culmination of what we've been building to for a long time through our entertainment-oriented mass media, through our incursions into the politics of fear that hit a fever pitch, I think, during the wars against terrorism after 9/11. And he has traded on this and basically expanded through great skill through the use of digital media and taking advantage of these media that are personal, visual, and instantaneous. He has captivated a lot of followers, and he has basically been able to extend the politics of fear and to not only minorities and not only terrorists, but religious minorities, especially with Islamophobia. And moreover, he has, I think, very significantly, he's changed the rules of public discourse. We used to make a strong distinction between public and private. And what people felt in private, even with politicians, usually didn't come out so strongly in public. And he has broken that line and is now basically said it's okay to say in public what you might have thought or feared in private. And thus we've got get this condemnation, this very strong racist, homophobic tones and so forth against a lot of people. And the final note I'd make about this is he has extended this to claim that the problem is not just with these groups that we should be fearful of. And this is important because most anger and hate is based on fear. But he's also said that the institutions that have enabled these minorities and these fearful people, those institutions are corrupt. And it is so bad that we must change the institutions, and that only one person is really capable of doing this, and that's Donald Trump.
Yeah, and in fact, it seems like, well, we might say saying the quiet part out loud, this willingness to talk about private discourse is one of the real attractions that Donald Trump has with his supporters, which I think is pretty striking. We'll certainly circle back to that, but I want to bring Roger Peterson. Roger, you've written about how this discourse had developed certainly since 9/11 and, you know, U.S. military intervention. Something I've been thinking about is in particular this notion of this dehumanization and particularly Islamophobia certainly dates to at least 9/11, you know, if not before that. Is this a logical extension of a lot of the discourse that we saw after the attacks on September the 11th?
Well, I should say that, you know, I'm a political scientist who studies violence. So I'm not a psychologist. I'm not an expert on dehumanization. And I think the two Davids are the experts on that. But seeing you brought it up, just let me take a minute and a half just to say, I think, why you have me on the program. So, you know, I study at the Security Studies Program, MIT. And as you mentioned, I just wrote a 600-page book on the Iraq War. So these are the things I actually work on. But I'm probably known as a political scientist who brings emotion in as an explanatory variable. Probably, I guess that's my claim to fame, which is why you have me on the program. But the other book you mentioned, Understanding Ethnic Violence, what I did there is I argued that events in Eastern Europe often produced widespread common emotion in a population that could orient it and drive it towards attacking a particular target. And there are many possible targets in Eastern Europe when the state broke down, but sometimes, you know, Ukrainians would attack Poles or Poles would attack Jews, but there was a lot of variation in that. So I looked at four distinct emotions: fear, which should predict that the violence should be towards the most threatening group; resentment, which has to do with a status reversal, and when you perceive that an emotion that comes from the perception that another group is unjustly dominant over you; hatred, which predicts that you go towards the common enemy that you see as both defective and a threat; or rage, which is frustration, aggression, which is you just need any target to find a scapegoat. And those were theories out there. And I tested them across a lot of cases in Eastern Europe. And what I found was that the resentment emotion about status reversals was a very good predictor of violence against groups. And so I guess on Trump, because we have now, you know, I actually think that human beings naturally identify with groups and that they are naturally see a status hierarchy. And in Eastern Europe, you saw that. And the book I just wrote on Iraq, the Shia saw themselves as unjustly subordinated. And the Shia now run Iraq, basically, and they are driven by resentment against Sunnis. And so in the United States, when you come to Trump, the question is how much are Trump followers driven by the idea of a status reversal? And what does that mean for the targeting of certain groups and whether they're directed to use violence? So that's, I think, my contribution here. And I'm anxious to learn more about the dehumanization, because I know the Davids know a lot more about that than I do. But dehumanization clearly makes it easier to act on and to, you know, violently act against another group. So, but the question for me is, you know, how coherent is Trump's message? And is it really, certainly I think there's resentment. I mean, I'm from rural Nebraska, but I live in the People's Republic of Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's just different ways you see the world in these two places. And the people in Nebraska are, you know, this isn't our country anymore. And so that is something that exists. But how much is it actually toward, you know, it's not really toward racial groups so much because Trump is actually making inroads with blacks and Hispanics. I'm not, the political rhetoric he has is, I have a comment here. We will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and radical left thugs that live like vermin. Well, to me, it's just like crazy. It's not targeted enough to get violence towards a group. Now, what David just said before me, though, is the immigrants seem to be a special, more specific target that this dehumanization is towards. And then I think that there are some individuals. Trump says, I'm your retribution. Well, what's his retribution against? But there's a my question about Trump is just how incoherent he is and whether he can actually get and mobilize this resentment that to turn it into something violent.
I wonder how much, because it's this emotional appeal, that whether or not there's a logical consistency, whether or not the argument has any sort of clarity, is less important than just sort of tapping into, you're mad, I'm mad, I will be your way to, to deal with your anger, even though there may not be a consistency around that, which then can open the door, David Livingston, to this question about dehumanization and this role that anger, fear, resentment, dehumanization have always seemingly played in political violence. Is this pattern in the United States matching some other historic patterns I know you've written about?
Oh, yes, it certainly does. But first, I'd like to riff on the last thing that the other David said about the erosion of the boundary between public and private. Part of the power of Trump's rhetoric is that he has given a lot of Americans permission to be authentic. So to say out loud what they would say in the corner of the bar with some of their buddies or on a hunting expedition, or whatever, and that's crack cocaine. That's power. That's very, very important. So what we have to see Trump's rhetoric is doing, I think, is primarily liberating suppressed attitudes that have never been adequately dealt with in the United States, that have been simmering away. And he does this very, very well. I don't think he understands exactly what he does. I think he has a salesman's instinct for what moves people. And you're absolutely right, Doug. I mean, I don't think logic influences the behavior of very many people, including academics. As David Hume emphasized back in the 18th century, it's the passions that do that. And Trump has a sense of what sort of rhetoric elicits the sorts of passions that he needs and he needs to harness for his political project. Now, to get to the heart of your question, as I mentioned to you earlier before we were on air, I've been writing about Trump since 2015, and more precisely since he made that speech where he came down the escalator and threw his hat into the ring. And I was listening to that speech, and I was extremely alarmed by it. Now, lots of my good liberal friends figuratively patted me on the head and said, "Silly boy, this is a joke. This is just going to be some amusement in the election season." But I was alarmed because I study authoritarian propaganda. And in particular, I'm interested in Nazi propaganda because it is so well documented, particularly for a monolinguistic person like myself. And I have been very influenced by a paper that was published in 1941. By a remarkable man. He had two PhDs in philosophy and anthropology and was a practicing psychoanalyst, a man named Roger Monicarle. Monicarle attended the 1932 speeches given by Hitler and Goebbels. And 9 years later, this paper was published. And I think the bit about the paper, which is just immensely valuable, consisted of his reflections on the rhetorical techniques that Hitler and Goebbels used, that he witnessed. And it was basically three moves that they would make. And the first is really counterintuitive. He would get the audience depressed. We're hopeless. We've been humiliated. We've been brought to our knees. We're the laughing stock of the world. Everyone is exploiting us. And then, as Monte Carlo says, once they're rolling around in an orgy of self-pity, he changes tune and says, well, you know, it's not really your fault. It's the enemy within. It's the Jews and the communists and the social democrats that are destroying us. So he works them up into paranoia. And then the final punchline is, only I can make Germany great again. So he presents himself as the savior. Join, you know, join us, and we will inaugurate a 1,000-year Reich where all of our enemies are brushed away with an iron broom. Now, I was alarmed at Trump's first speech because he made precisely those moves. It wasn't the Jews and the communists. It was the Mexicans crossing the southern border, rapists and murderers. In the second bit, in the first bit, he emphasized everyone's laughing at us, everyone's taking advantage of us, Mexico is, China is, and so on. And the culmination was the magical, one might say, manic solution, only I can save this country. And in establishing his following, he did this quite frequently. He did this sequence. Now that he has a substantial following, he's still not quite as regularly, but he still does this. Hence the dehumanizing remarks, which could have come right out of a Hitler speech. I mean, let's be honest, poisoning the blood of our nation, and these are vermin he's going to root out. That's part of that second move, that paranoia, that fear-producing move. So he knows how to do this, and it's really a standard authoritarian rhetorical practice that he is performing.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about Donald Trump's rhetoric, about the construction of the rhetoric, about emotions in politics, dehumanizing tendencies, and what this means for American politics. Our guests today are David Livingstone Smith of the University of New England, Roger Peterson of MIT, and David Altaïti of Arizona State University. And David Altaïti, I want to turn to you because, I mean, something that David Livingstone Smith just said was that immediately came to mind then is this use of the idea of enemies, the enemy of the people, the enemy of the state. There's institutions, the press is the enemy of the people. Facebook, most recently, his justification for opposing a ban on TikTok is because Facebook is the real enemy of the people. It's something that certainly seems unique and stands out, how it's not just my opponent, predecessor, it's the enemy. That is fairly unique, right, for American politics?
I think it's unique partly because it's so pervasive. In terms of the digital media in our age, in my view, Trump's existence depended on digital media, okay? Because he was able to manufacture almost individualized messages that are short, pithy, personalized, and that people then could identify with, participate in, and share with others, and therefore gain status as claiming to have messages directly from Donald Trump. And so those kinds of things contributed to, I think, this permission to break the boundaries between public and private, to say what you were thinking all the time, and indeed to sidestep the institutional barriers that basically separated you from the experts. So the problem then became for Trump, all these experts have been wrong. All these institutions, forms of government, school boards, authors, publishers, librarians, they're all wrong. We know what the truth is. We know what we should be doing. And all of these people, these enemies, they have a lot in common. Sociologists call this othering. More and more people are now others on the outside of the pale. I think Professor Peterson's comments about resentment resonate with that. He taps in to this sense of that we can resent the people that are really coming after us. The recent book by on caste spells a lot of this out, how especially poor whites, less educated whites, can resent the minorities that are gaining on them. Evangelical Christians can resent, and they're given permission now to get politically involved, much stronger, against the people who do not share their beliefs about Christianity and the role that government should play in promoting their own morality. And this is all very powerful. And he said it so often, and it's become so common. There's one final point I'd like to make. The logic doesn't matter at all. What matters is that it resonates anger, resentment, and you're under attack to the point now where Donald Trump, a lot of communication scholars argue, has become a meme. He's become a meme. His followers don't even need to listen to what he says. They no longer care, his hardcore followers. He's there. He's fighting for us. That's enough. The image is what matters.
What's interesting with that, though, is some of those narratives existed certainly prior to Trump. One that immediately comes to mind that is the so-called war on Christmas, that, you know, the evangelical Christians in particular, you know, had this perception. We've known this for years. It's kind of become almost a joke that after Thanksgiving, you turn on Fox News and there's going to be stories about the war on Christmas, which then kind of raises the question, is Trump creating this or is he advancing this? And Roger, I want to turn to you. This is a political science question I always wrestle with. That's what my training is in as well. Is Trump and our leaders generally across the board creating this sense, or are they just kind of unleashing it and it's out there? In other words, is Trump leading this, or did he just kind of pull the lid off and it's kind of blown up?
This is it's a major question if you study emotions, because clearly how we perceive the world, beliefs create emotions, but also our emotions are shaping our beliefs, and these two are back and forth. So is Trump actually creating cognitive antecedents, they'd say, or beliefs about the world that make people resentful? Or did the world just get this way because they see the world going badly and they already have these resentments, and Trump is using those as his tool? And I guess in the political scientists debate this, I'm on the idea that society sort of goes a certain way and leaders use that what they can as a tool, that they don't create it. Now with Trump, though, and David Eltida got into this, we're a thing I don't understand is the internet and how you can actually maybe really bend stuff. And maybe we are in a little different world, but I believe actually that the demographics and the decline of religion and all these things were creating a world which was breeding resentments, and Trump has been a master at using them, and that Trump hasn't really created them. So that's my position on that. And just quickly, you asked about historical precedents, and you had the war on Christmas, but I think the two that would come up with political scientists, probably George Wallace used rhetoric quite well and got 13% of the vote in just the South. It was a rhetoric that was building again on status change among groups in the South. And then probably the other one political scientists think about is McCarthyism and the whole idea about disease that Professor Smith brought up, that there's a rot in our institutions and we have to be fearful of it. So there's sort of that we've had big cases of generating fear in McCarthyism. And I think also the status change, which came with the, in the South and George Wallace. And so those are the two that I think come up. But on the whole, I believe that, you know, our society was headed a certain way and Trump is not, he's using it more than he's creating it.
And Professor Smith, then you said you heard the speech and you immediately got, you know, afraid that Trump was using this technique, though we're not sure that I feel comfortable saying he wasn't trained in it. It's actually something that's kind of going by the gut. But there's definitely language that he's used, you know, in the very beginning. I mean, some of the dehumanizing language, we've spoken about migrants and asylum seekers. And now that's even elevated to the point where just denying the humanity of anybody, you know, at the border. I mean, at some level, I think it's fair to say he's responding to positive reinforcement that he's getting from crowds and he's getting from supporters. Is that really what's going on here? That he's, the image I have, he's unleashed this tiger and he's trying to ride the tiger. And if it ends up taking you in a direction like dehumanizing immigrants, that Trump is going there and it's going to have profound impacts on the way we view this, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's extremely concerning if we look at the historical precedents. But notice it's not just immigrants, it's certain immigrants. You'll recall that he would welcome immigration from Norway and Sweden. Mm-hmm. So dehumanization, if we're talking about dehumanization, I think we have to be, first of all, very careful about the use of the term, partially because it means a whole lot of different things, and it often casts more heat than light. So let me be explicit about what I mean by dehumanization. Dehumanization is the attitude of conceiving of others as less than human creatures. Now that's an entirely psychological characterization, so we have to add something to it, which is that dehumanization is a psychological response to political forces. So it's the impact of propaganda and ideologies and people in positions of authority who are trusted that elicits dehumanizing attitudes. Now, dehumanization is closely linked historically with racialization, by which I mean that groups that are demonized are typically, it's not universal by any, not human beings, it's universal, but typically they're seen as fundamentally different from us. The other day, David spoke about othering. This is a kind of othering. Fundamentally, not contingently, not superficially, but fundamentally. And that this difference is handed down by descent and these others are placed on a hierarchy below us, whoever we are. In the most dangerous and toxic forms of dehumanization, these others are not simply seen as subhuman creatures, but rather as monstrous beings, as actually immensely powerful. We see this again and again historically. And that has a particular consequence. So if you're dealing with monsters, no measure is too harsh.
Right.
So the kind of rhetoric we hear from Trump periodically, you know, most recently, there was the mention of bloodbaths following on from they're not people. these folks allegedly coming across the border from Latin American prisons. That was his claim. They're not people, they're animals. That's a very, very dangerous step. And we all think, you know, it can't happen here. Well, it can happen anywhere.
Donald Trump is actually rather old. It's not clear how long he is personally going to be in the political landscape. It's not clear how long he's going to be around delivering these speeches. But is Trumpism separate from Trump, the person? And what does this mean for the future of American politics?
When we come back, will Trump's language of hate outlive the man, or will it survive even after he passes on? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Increasingly, the Republican Party has joined the Trumpian politics of hate, fear, and resentment. Will this direction continue? And if not, how might it shift? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we are discussing the rhetoric at the rhetorical tools, the emotions that are connected with the candidate, the former President Donald Trump, concerns about dehumanization, about violence, about enemies of the state, etc., and what this means for the future of American politics. Our panel today is David Livingstone Smith, professor of philosophy at the University of New England, Roger Peterson, the Arthur and Ruth Sloan professor of political science at MIT, and David Altaidi, Regents Professor Emeritus on the faculty of Justice and Social Inquiry in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University. David, I'll turn to you and ask this broad question. We speak a lot about Trumpism, but I think it's fair to say that what Trump is representing is not something that's ideologically cohesive. So I guess first is, what is Trumpism, and is it becoming divorced from Donald Trump, the person?
I think that Trumpism greatly extends beyond the man. Throughout history, as Professor Smith points out, there have been numerous tyrants, psychopaths, sociopaths, call them what you will, who had ideas. I mean, there was George Wallace, and they were always blatant racists and so on. But they didn't have a lot of followers. And that's what's very different today. Okay, so part of the challenge is to understand not so much the symbolic leader, in this case, Donald Trump, and people have done a good job, I think, of dealing with the psychology of it and the pathology of him. But that's not the big issue. It's why the other followers? How do you get millions and millions of voters? How do you get a large number of members of Congress? And around the country, in state and local governments, they're even more expansive following this. And I think that's the key part of your question. This is attractive. This has grown. It has been okay to do this. And the main symbol about this is liberation, as has been already suggested. We need to liberate ourselves from these controls, indeed, even our constitutional controls. We need to liberate ourselves from these corrupt institutions, elections, school boards, library boards, universities. It's in the military, they're promoting women's rights. It cuts across. So we need to purge and change these institutions. And so what we're promoting now is this new form of governments that I call gonzo governance. It's his sense that everything has fallen apart and we need to rebuild and get rid of these conventional controls. And that's what's attractive. And that is going to continue to be okay long after Donald Trump, I think, is gone, unless the power of the vote is strong enough to change the direction. Unless you get enough people getting voted out of office and out of positions of power, I think we're going to continue to see this for a long time. And indeed, it's spread throughout the world. It's now permissible, partly because of the United States position. It's now permissible to take on established institutions, established entrenchments about equal rights, about human rights, and so forth. And this is very profound.
And David Livingstone Smith, I know you've done quite a bit of research in Nazi Germany. The thing that's always struck me, the historian part of me, is in Germany how quickly these established political parties, legal scholars, the judges, et cetera, really kind of bent to the will of the authoritarians. And I see what's happened with the Republican Party, a party that was very, very uncomfortable with Donald Trump in 2016, with a number of leaders, you know, figures talking about how this was dangerous. We shouldn't nominate him. And just so quickly falling in line. How did this happen? And is this just simply, you know, he won, so we're gonna support him? Or is the Republican Party, do you imagine the Republican Party has been changed in the same way that German parties became changed?
Yes, of course. There are different phases of what happened in Germany, and that you use the term bringing into line. That's exactly the term that the Nazis used, Gleichschaltung. It's bringing into line. They were very smart about doing that. They were way smarter than the MAGA movement about doing that. But the MAGA movement has been very successful in bringing the Republican Party into line. I mean, a lot of these folks have a sense of, you know, where their bread is buttered. And they are acting accordingly. With respect to, I would like to go back a little bit to the previous question. I mean, I think we've all indicated that we think that what Trump has done is tapped something pre-existing. And if that's the case, then of course Trumpism is something distinct from Trump. And this is actually one of my big worries. Because Trump does not have anything like a coherent ideology. But the next guy might. The Steve Bannon type person might. It might be someone who's much more intelligent, not just intelligent from the gut, but much more intelligent from the head. And that would be way more dangerous than what Trump is doing. With respect to, now going back to your question, look, when these passions are released, when they're given permission, when the genie's let out of the bottle, change can happen incredibly rapidly. And you give the example of Nazi Germany, 3 years it took to have a dictatorship. I mean, a remarkable transformation. And by the way, many people would have said that in the 1930s, Germany was the least anti-Semitic country in Europe. What a transformation. So things can turn on a dime. And this is hard for us to think because we take so much for granted about the way our society is structured. And we take so much for granted about the robustness of our institutions. But they really need to be aggressively defended against these unmaking forces.
If I could just...
Yes, Roger, please.
Come in on this. I mean, so I grew up in a small town and right in the Iowa-Nebraska border. If you look at Iowa went for Obama. That's where Obama started. Is Hillary was supposed to go in 2008, but people were very enthusiastic for Obama in Iowa. They voted for him solidly in 2008, voted for him because he was an outsider. There's, you know, people have a vague sense that there's something wrong, but it's sort of a vague sense. And by the time Trump got in, it was like, we still need an outsider and we didn't get anything with Obama. Let's go another step further radically. And now Iowa is a, it used to be a, you know, a mixed state. Now it's purely red. But these are very decent people who now are like Trump supporters. And this is what's most disturbing to me, is that, you know, they've been sucked into this, but it's again, the, this lack of faith in institutions, and something's gone wrong in our government. And now though, it's hard even to go against it. It's hard even to have a conversation against Trump.
Well, I think if I may,
go ahead, David.
That this also, I think, illustrates the power of the politics of fear. All of these issues resonate the notion that you are under attack, your family's not safe, your jobs are not safe, our country isn't safe, your religion's not safe, you know, they're going to tear down your crosses, minorities are moving in, they're coming all over the place. Professor Smith's comments resonates with what Professor Peterson said. We have never seen a situation where government officials, including people prominent in the mass media, are now welcoming autocrats to our country, feting them, suggesting that Hungary, for example, their illiberal democracy could be a very good model for the United States. And when you get people interviewed on the street, as uninformed as we might think they are, when you get people saying, you know, maybe a dictatorship wouldn't be so bad if it's the right kind of dictatorship, if it will, you know, let us reclaim, for example, that we are a Christian nation, which we should have always been. And you've got to remember, we've had situations now where the wife of a Supreme Court justice has been supporting, you know, the attempt at insurrection. Now, this is massive stuff. These aren't just a few kooks. And so I think the power of the politics of fear that grabs these people around and says, we better get together to save ourselves.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we are examining Trumpism, Donald Trump, the rhetoric of Donald Trump and what this means for American politics, with David Livingstone Smith of the University of New England, Roger Peterson of MIT, and David Altaiti of Arizona State University. And David Livingstone Smith, but David Altaiti just said, you know, really resonates in that, again, the idea that this has become embedded within the Republican Party in an increasing number of very powerful people are tapping into these ideas. I've always presumed that's because their perception is that's what's popular, that, again, trying to respond to the population more than necessarily trying to move it. So my question is, this has been unleashed. Is there any going back?
Well, there might be. Depends how things pan out. I think one of the really important factors here, just kind of riffing off what the other David said, is the politics of fear is also the politics of salvation. That is, you generate fear and then you promise salvation. And so authoritarian politics like this, like the style that is going down in this country, is sort of like a quasi-religious movement where the leader is God. And of course, traditionally, the God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. And let's take them one by one, all-knowing. So whatever the leader says is true. Evidence is irrelevant to what he says. It's true by definition. No matter how vile his behavior appears, it's got to be good. And all powerful, he is the only one who can rescue us from this this induced sense of helplessness and vulnerability. Again, that's powerful stuff. So, of course, politicians are often motivated, very often motivated. It's a very important motivation by the need for votes and to go along with what is popular amongst their constituencies. But this kind of movement elicits a kind of true believer mentality as well. So we shouldn't think of these people as simply behaving in a sort of cynical manner. If they were, it would be more hopeful, right? But if they are true believers, that's where the real danger. I would prefer insincerity to sincerity in this context.
Roger Peterson, I was thinking about this as well, this emotions in politics, because we've framed this as, okay, we've got one side that's very emotional, you know, driven by resentment, driven by fear, et cetera. But the other side, the opponents of Trump, first of all, become incredibly emotional in the, you know, in this response. And there is no doubt that the politics of fear is driving a lot of people potentially vote for a president that's really quite unpopular. In fact, it seems like the Biden campaign's strategy is, if we can make you afraid of enough of Donald Trump, you'll vote for us, even though you don't really like what we've done. So ultimately, the question is, does emotion just simply breed other emotion? And therefore, I mean, if one side's promoting resentment, possibly fear, it just inevitably the other side ends up engaging in the same types of emotional politics.
Well, I think, you know, people in Cambridge, Massachusetts are also emotional and they do have fear. The difference, and I think Professor Smith had alluded, or maybe both Davids did, but this whole idea about attacks on our institutions. And if you just say institutions don't matter anymore, the law doesn't matter anymore, then we are in serious problems, I think. And so somehow we have to get back to a belief that our institutions are, you know, they have to be allowed to work. And I think, you know, some disaster, you could get, I don't know about new leadership coming, but I think the Republicans need to lose several elections in a row. And then that might be the thing that, you know, we have to, the world has changed. We will. And this is my idea about resentment. You resent the fact that another group gets on top of you, or you have to be equal with other groups. Actually, that's, you don't even like being equal to other groups. But once that's established, it's not going to change. Then people will eventually adjust. This is actually in my Iraq book. The Sunnis had been the dominant group in Iraq, and the Kurds had their dominant place. Well, it took about 15 years for the Shia, for the Sunnis and Kurds, to, and it took disasters like ISIS and other disasters before the other groups said, hey, they're the majority group and they're going to rule in a democracy. It just takes that long for this emotion to dissipate and for you to come up with that. And America is changing. Our demography's changing. If you go to Sioux City, Iowa, I mean, whole sections of the town are now Mexican. I mean, it is a change. And it's going to take people a while to get there. But hopefully in the meantime, I think it's going to take the Republicans losing and, you know, going back to say, we got to go back to our institutions. America has changed and we're going to have to accept it, even if we don't like it. And the intensity of this emotion can fade. And that's what I see happening. And luckily, some of the, you know, people the Republicans are putting up are so far, they're just not very smart and they're going to lose. But, you know, that doesn't guarantee it. It will be bad. And I think something day that one day, but if we are in like fear, Trump, I think, and this is why right now I don't see violence, because he's not been coherent enough to identify a specific target enough. But a new leader could do that. And then we could get something very dangerous happening in the country.
Yeah. Well, if I just add, I think that's a very insightful comment. Professor Smith suggested that, you know, having cynical people is maybe more dangerous than, I mean, it's not as, they're more flexible. True believers, you can't do anything with. Well, I think there's good news and bad news here. I mean, part of it, I'm an optimist. I'm a grandfather, so I have to be. Okay. I mean, a lot of our elected leaders are very cynical, and they're opportunists. And they will change and back off and move a bit if elections don't go in their favor. I think that would be a big change, and not only at the presidential level, but at state and local levels. And I'm still very confident that the majority of American people can still see their way through and not go through the extreme, the radical kind of approach. Polls suggest that a lot of Americans are not really religious. Now, that's very important. And given the demographics, that's a very important thing. But I think that if ballot boxes don't go the way that leadership wants it, then some of those leaders are going to fall out of favor in a hurry. Not completely, but they're going to be diminished. And that's where I think Professor Peters' comments make a lot of sense. You might start seeing things backing off, slacking off, and having more faith again in some institutions.
Professor Peterson, actually, for all three of you, this is going to sound odd that I'm the pessimist in the group here, because for two presidential elections, Donald Trump lost the popular vote fairly dramatically. Since 2016, the Republicans really have not done terribly well in congressional races. They've lost some, number of races that they had no business losing. Yet the Republican Party continues to kind of double down on this. And it seems as though you always hear the same, it's this appeal to the base that, Professor Peterson, I'll ask you this specifically then. This seems to be an emotional connection that a rationalist approach, Republicans would say, we haven't been winning. We need to do something different. But instead, they're just continuing, down this same pathway. So is this emotion taking root over,
Well, I think you're exaggerating the law. I mean, the Republicans control, they have a majority in the House, right? That's not a disaster enough electorally. The Senate, had they not elected a complete moron like Herschel Walker, they might control the Senate. They have to be beaten like Roosevelt beat Hoover in order for this to change, I think, and introduce something new. And just to pick up on one thing Professor Smith said, are the losers still true believers? So then they won't stop. And but the other thing is, then if you just believe you're going to lose, and even the Republican Party doesn't, in our two-party system, then do you become nihilists? There's just no meaning in our system. And I don't know whether nihilists, or maybe they're a good thing, but at any rate, that's the alternative I see for a lot of the people in the Republican Party, especially older people. They're either going to stick with the, Trump all the way, or they're going to just see our system as useless and maybe get out of the way, or maybe just keep voting for even more extreme people. To tell you, my profession, political scientist, we didn't predict Donald Trump. So I'm going to stay away from predictions.
I always like
bit.
To say 2016, my initial response was I never felt dumber about American politics, and try not to make those predictions. But with that in mind, we've got about 90 seconds left. So David Livingstone Smith, I'm going to give you the last word on this as well. What ultimately are the things that you're looking for to see just how rooted this is versus the possibility that we could actually reverse course here and return back to a politics of empathy and a politics of real humanism rather than dehumanization?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that might be a slight idealization of the past there. It's more about the robustness of institutions and support of institutions that matters. But I think it's worth reflecting on that we seem to have converged on the hope that Republican politicians will be opportunistic. And that says a lot.
I think that's a great point to end on. We've been discussing today the rhetoric
of Donald Trump. What is Trumpism? What are the political ramifications, the political implications of this approach, and what those implications mean for the 2024 election and going forward? Our panel today has been David Livingstone Smith. He's professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He's the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, The Most Dangerous Animal, Human Nature and the Origins of War, and Making Monsters, The Uncanny Power of Dehumanization. Roger Peterson is the Arthur and Ruth Sloan Professor of Political Science at MIT. He's the author of Understanding Ethnic Violence, Fear, Hatred, Resentment in 20th Century Eastern Europe, Death, Domination, and State Building, The U.S. in Iraq and the Future of American Military Intervention, and Emotions and Backlash in U.S. Society and Politics. And David Altaidi, Regents Professor Emeritus on the Faculty of Justice and Social Inquiry in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University. He's the author of Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and The Media Syndrome and Gonzo Governance, The Media Logic of Donald Trump. Thank you all very much for joining us, for sharing your insights, sharing your research, and sharing this conversation. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.